This week on Disaffected, we're going to talk about the tent revival at the House of Representatives, where Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and friends mounted their passion play and got everybody to be bathed in tears of joy and affirmation. Then we'll take a look at the creepy weirdness going on at the New York Times, where 150 staffers took aim at veteran science writer Don McNeil for referring to the N-word at all and demanded his firing, which they got. And then McNeil himself wrote a hostage letter mortifying his own flesh in public and telling everybody what a horrible person he was. And to wrap it all up, we'll take another look at the world of trans affirmation, where a male bodybuilder put on a wig and got himself a couple of fake tits and managed to convince the UK's Independent to do an article on his coming out as his true and authentic self. All of that coming up today on Disaffected. Welcome to Disaffected. I'm Joshua Slocum. On this show, we talk about the ways that abuse dynamics and personality disorder type behaviors that many of us recognize from abusive parents, domestic abuse, family violence in the home, how that has seeped out into the public sphere. And in the past, particularly 10 years, but I'd say over the past 20 or 30 years, how these personality disorder type behaviors, the narcissism, the attention seeking, and the cruelty have started to structure our public conversation and the way we relate to other people. And this is most acutely seen on the left today. So what we're going to talk about is what I can only call a religious tent revival in Congress with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Dog and Pony Show, where she talked about her trauma from the riot at the Capitol and then invited a bunch of other lawmakers to both flatter her and cry crocodile tears for all of us as well on our money as taxpayers. Then we're going to talk about what seems to be a bad case of Stockholm syndrome at the New York Times with their recent firing of longtime science reporter Don McNeil and his committing Harry Caray afterwards in public in a quite disturbing letter. So let's get right into Congress. So most of you know that on last week's show, we talked about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's reaction to the riots at the Capitol on January 6th. And like most of the mainstream media, Ocasio-Cortez and many other people on the left have a lot invested in bigging this up and calling it an insurrection, calling it an attempted coup. Obviously, what happened at the Capitol was criminal behavior, and those people need to be prosecuted. And if I had been at the Capitol that day, I'm sure that I, too, would have been at the very least nervous and possibly scared. So nothing I'm about to say here means that I don't recognize the criminality of this behavior. I do. I just don't accept that it's an insurrection and I don't accept that it's a coup. And I don't accept that it is this uniquely scarring event that justifies our elected representatives basically having an episode of Dr. Phil on the House floor and expecting all of us to applaud and give them
yes, queen.
Which is exactly what they're looking for. So after I recorded the show last week, I think the day after or the day after that, AOC went on Instagram and talked about, she narrated her experience on January 6th about hiding in her office, about being frightened that people were going to come in. And again, I'm not going to second guess her on being frightened. I think a lot of us probably would have been frightened, too. But I don't really think that that was the purpose of her going on Instagram. I think the purpose of her going on Instagram was to gin up excess sympathy. It is true that she was not, in fact, in the building with the dome. It's true that in retrospect, it doesn't appear that she was actually in danger. That doesn't mean that she knew that at the time. Right. So I think some critics are going too far and saying, you know, she was never in danger. She knew she wasn't in danger. I think that's a little bit too ungenerous. However, it's not that reaction that I want to talk about. It's what she did with it afterwards. And I can't help but notice that her performance on Instagram, this is when she said, you know, I was standing behind the bathroom door and then somebody she did not know was a Capitol police officer banged on the door and said, where is she? Again, get it. She was scared. But why did she have to rehearse this again on camera in front of people? And then why did she have to bring in her sexual assault, which had nothing to do with what happened at the Capitol? I saw so many people in the mainstream media and on social media tearfully applauding this and saying, you know, you go, girl, this is so brave. Does it really take any bravery these days to talk about your trauma on camera? Really? I mean, it seems like all people actually want to talk about anymore. And for those of you, well, for those of you who listened to the last show and those of you who didn't, I talked about a phenomenon that I call the wounded bird camouflage. And this is a behavior that some people use, and it's particularly pronounced in some of the cluster B personality disorders. And as a reminder, there are four cluster B personality disorders: borderline, histrionic, narcissistic, and antisocial. Antisocial is also known as sociopathy or psychopathy. These are cluster B. There's clusters A, B, and C. Cluster B disorders are known as the erratic or dramatic personality disorders. And what binds them together, although they have differences, the four of them, they have some very core common characteristics, which is why they're grouped together. What binds them together is self-obsession and narcissism. Yes, all four of them, even though only one has the name narcissistic personality disorder. Inward-looking, self-obsessed, solipsistic, and a lack of empathy for the legitimate needs and feelings of other people. And in some people, this expresses itself in histrionics. Overblown emotional performances, particularly if a person can make him or herself look like a victim and cry and emote on camera, they use this as camouflage. It's almost, you know, it's an emotional shield, you know, boom, boom. Anybody who says you're not being genuine is, you know, erasing your trauma. Look at it a little differently. I was watching Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in her Instagram appearance, and she seemed to me to, well, she's very good, right? She's very good at weaponizing her emotions or her alleged emotions in order to manipulate people into wanting to either care for her or protect her in some way. She gets, I'm sorry, there's no other way to do this. This is what she does. She starts to talk in a really little girl kind of voice, gets really, really small, like she was scared, and she makes really big eyes and, you know, just, I'm allergic to this kind of thing because I can't see it as legitimate. And it works on people. It works on men and it works on women. First of all, she's a very attractive woman. She's lovely to look at. And regardless of what you think about that, attractive people tend to get more attention and people tend to take them more seriously. This is just human nature. She knows that and she uses it. She appeals to men because she's very pretty. She's lovely to look at. She's got a great figure. And she appeals to women as well because she embodies something that many women, I think, see as a reflection of themselves. When they feel like they have been mistreated by men, when they have been spoken over, when they weren't taken seriously. And it's reasonable. You can understand why somebody would identify with that. Many women have had this experience. But it's so exaggerated and so put on with her. And I would like to suggest, consider consider it through this lens. What if this weren't a genuine expression of feeling, you know, so fearful and what if instead you saw this as manipulation? You know, the body language, the big eyes, the really small voice. It's almost as if she's trying to be at the same time a seductress and a scared child. And it seems to work on people. Well, that wasn't enough. Now we had to do it in the House of Representatives. So what was it? Was it this past Thursday? I'm not quite sure what to call it. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez had an event in the House of Representatives where she recounted her experience yet again and invited her colleagues to do the same. And some of them recounted their experiences and their terror. Most of them flattered her. And called her courageous, and thank you for convening us together. And some of them took an opportunity to pose as her male protector, like Dean Phillips from Minnesota, and lecture us in a stentorian voice about how we shouldn't be invalidating anybody's trauma. Let's take a look at a clip with AOC starting this event off.
To minimize, discredit, or belittle the accounts of survivors. In doing so, they not only further harm those who were there that day and provide cover for those responsible, but they also send a tremendously damaging message to survivors of trauma all across this country, that the way to deal with trauma, violence, and targeting is to paper it over, minimize it, and move on. Sadly, this is all too often what we hear from survivors of trauma as the reason why they don't get care. That what they experienced wasn't bad enough or too bad to talk about, or that they are afraid of being invalidated, accused of exaggeration, or making a mountain out of a molehill.
Okay. What she's talking about may be appropriate for a session on a therapist's couch, but I struggle to see why it is appropriate to talk about on the floor of the House of Representatives. What's the purpose here? This is going out on C-SPAN. All the networks are carrying this. And all this talk about survivors of trauma, invalidated. I mean, all of these buzzwords that you hear from the liberal left right now, they sound like a parody of a therapy session. And, you know, I go to therapy myself. I see a therapist twice a month. And we talk about politics as much as we talk about the issues from my past because, you know, as I've said before, waking up to the fact that I had lived most of my life being manipulated by my mother, who has both borderline and narcissistic personality disorders and can put on these ginned up histrionics just as well as anyone else. It really distorts your point of view and it gets you to a place where you're really willing to accept any over emoting and to stop any criticism from coming out of your mouth because you don't want somebody to say they feel invalidated or they don't feel heard. This is not our job as taxpayers. We're not Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's therapist. Neither are her colleagues in the House. Let's go on to, let's take a listen to Dean Phillips, Representative Dean Phillips from Minnesota.
I want to thank you, my friend, the gentlelady from New York, for organizing tonight and for inspiring rising generations of Americans, including my own daughters, to dream bigger and to do better. I want to thank you. And I want to start my remarks by addressing those who have belittled, dismissed, minimized, or criticized anyone who has experienced trauma of any type, at any time, in any form.
Did you feel lectured too? I sure did. It's like the, you know, the headmaster of a school wagging his finger at people. Did Dean Phillips actually get his?
Yes, queen.
I think he did. I think. Well, actually, I know he did, because like any good person who engages in histrionics, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez not only features her own histrionics on Twitter, but she retweets other people talking about her histrionics. So anytime somebody congratulates her, anytime somebody says you're so courageous, she retweets it. I mean, it's as thick as it's frosting on a cake. Then we have Representative Sheila Jackson Lee.
Let me thank the gentlelady from New York, first of all, for her courage and for convening us together. And I might say to the gentlelady that we're not doing this for ourselves.
I might say you are. We're not doing this for ourselves. I swear to God, these people all think they're Eva Perón. This is all for Argentina. Did you catch the double mask, by the way? That was very virtue. Very, very virtue of Representative Sheila Jackson Lee. Double masking. But The real show stealer that evening was Rashida Tlaib. I mean, this is just gold. Here we go.
Thank you so much to my colleague for her incredible courage. I asked her to go last because I get because this is so personal. This is so hard because, as many of my colleagues know, my closest colleagues know, on my very first day of orientation, I got my first death threat. It was a serious one. They took me aside. The FBI had to go to the gentleman's home. I didn't even get sworn in yet when someone wanted me dead for just existing.
Someone wanted me dead for just existing. Keep that phrase in mind, wanted me dead for just existing. We're going to return to it later and in future episodes of the show. What I want to note about that, this is a classic move by people with narcissistic tendencies. As a reminder to everybody listening and watching, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not diagnosing anybody because I can't diagnose anybody. But am I suggesting that there is a pattern of behavior that fits the cluster B personality type? Yes, I am suggesting. It's up to you to judge. But what this show wants to do is to connect these dots and ask you to consider connecting the same dots too. So this wanting to hurt me just for existing, you hear this a lot in trans activism. And the complaint is, you know, well, those terrible women didn't use my pronouns. They're threatening my very existence. They're trying to erase my existence as a trans woman. This is usually said in response to someone who says, hey, this is your life to live the way you want to live it. You can dress as you like. You can use whatever name you like. I don't want you to be fired from your job. I don't want you not to have scholarship opportunities. I don't want you to be persecuted in front of the law. But I'm not going to tell you that I believe you're a woman because you are not. You're denying my very existence. This is easy to dismiss on its face, but there is actually something a little more complicated going on here that has to do with a narcissistic mindset. It's easy to say, oh, these people don't believe that, you know, what a bunch of overloaded nonsense. And to some degree, I think that's true. But there is a sense in which many people like this internally really do experience it this way. And I'm going to come back to a phrase that you will hear from me many times. I'm offering an explanation. I am not offering an excuse. Explanations are not excuses. So when I say this looks like cluster B behavior, or this might be informed by this kind of personality, I'm not saying it to you in the way that people say, oh, don't criticize her when she has a meltdown. She's autistic and she can't help it. That is not what I'm doing. Everyone is responsible for governing their own behavior, and this is not a condition that's the cluster B personality type where you can absolve a person of responsibility. Even if it isn't consciously manipulative, and sometimes maybe it isn't, but a lot of times it is, it doesn't actually matter in the end. People are still responsible for themselves. But when they say, you're erasing my very existence, they're actually confessing something to you that's quite serious. You will hear people talk about the mask of the narcissist or the false self of the narcissist. And moving over to borderline personality disorder, one of the other ones, one of the foundational diagnostic criteria for borderline personality disorder is an unstable self-image and an unstable and insecure sense of personal identity. So what does that look like in the real world? Well, maybe somebody say, I don't know who I am. Or I don't know who I am without this friendship circle or without these accessories. Or it might be somebody who changes their look constantly or changes their philosophical point of view, or one day identifies as a social justice knitter and the next week it's you know, bowling to end racism. This unstable sense of identity is something that many people with cluster B traits or disorders share. So when they believe that the mask they're presenting is their real self. I call this Tinkerbell ontology. So you remember the story of Peter Pan and the part in the play where the audience is asked to clap for Tinkerbell to keep her existing, right? You have to believe in Tinkerbell. This is what people do with this trans stuff. In order for their, quote, identity to be real or to be valid or not to be erased, we all have to clap for Tinkerbell and say, I do believe in fairies. I do believe in this. Yes, yes, yes. So I don't think that any of us should indulge this. I don't think that any of us are obligated to sit and soothe somebody who throws that kind of tantrum in public or puts those remarks out there. It's not your job. It's not my job to validate a trans woman. We all have to validate ourselves, and any good therapist will tell you that. Part of the work of therapy is learning how to validate yourself without relying on external crutches and other people as crutches. So when you hear erasing my existence, think of that. You know, think about the fact that somebody might be saying it cynically, but they may also be giving you a window into the distorted frame of mind and the distorted and weak sense of self-image that propels so much of this behavior. I got to give you a little more from Rashida Tlaib because she was really going for the Oscar with this.
More came later, uglier, more violent. One celebrating and writing the New Zealand massacre and hoping that more would come. Another mentioning my dear son, Adam. Mentioning him by name.
Like you're doing now.
Each one paralyzed me each time. So what happened on January 6th, all I could do was thank Allah that I wasn't here. I felt overwhelming relief, and I feel bad for Alexandria, so many of my colleagues that were here. But as I saw it, I thought to myself, thank God, I am not there. I saw the images that they didn't get to see until later. My team and I decided at that point we'd keep the death threats away. We'd try to report them, document them, to keep them away from me, because it just paralyzed me, and all I wanted to do was come here and serve the people that raised me.
What the hell is that? What is that? I've engaged in histrionics myself, but I've never been that bad. And I'll tell you what, if you ever catch me doing something like that, call the Undertaker because it's time for my cremation. I've obviously been on this earth too long. This is ridiculous. And first of all, I talk about this with my producer on the show. I talk about these things with friends. I try to get a sense of how I'm going to address this when I come on every week. And I battle between wanting to deride and mock things that I think are worthy of mockery, but also not wanting to be so convinced that I'm right that I fail to consider the possibility that, you know, somebody's really feeling or experiencing what they claim. So, you know, you may have a disagreement. Other people may see it differently. And if so, you can tell me. I can't take any of this seriously. I mean, I'm watching this. First of all, I'm listening to it. And yes, it does remind me of my mother. It does remind me of my mother. I told a story last week about how she put on a performance when she went to her sister's funeral and felt that she'd been snubbed by the family because she wasn't mentioned in the eulogy. She wasn't positioned in the right place in the receiving line. And, you know, it was this kind of, frankly, blubbering that we were treated to, we kids in my house, all the time. You know, and everybody acted like I was the black sheep, and I just couldn't believe it. It was just awful. Blah, blah, blah. Oh, my goodness. It's so overwrought. And at least my mother could turn on the tears. But I didn't see any with Rashida here. I mean, I saw this, but, you know, her hand didn't look wet. I mean, maybe we're not looking at high def video here, but that really looks to me like crocodile tears. I'm going to come to the end of this topic, but I just need to give her one more so she can go for the gold.
The trauma from just being here, existing as a Muslima, is so hard, but imagine my team, which I lovingly just adore. They are diverse. I have LGBTQ staff. I have a beautiful Muslima that wears her hijab proudly in the halls. I have Black women that are so proud to be here to serve their country, and I worry every day for their lives because of this rhetoric.
Okay, no, that's enough. I won't subject you to any more of that. Muslima, LGBT, Black women. Did you catch it again? You know, just existingness of Muslima. When have people had such a goddamn hard time existing before the past 4 or 5 years? I mean, what is it about existing as a Muslima that is so difficult? I want specifics. Don't you? Do you accept this? Because it seems to me, these days, I don't believe anyone's claim of oppression simply because they've made that claim, because it's become so easy and cheap these days to raise your hands and say, as a gay man and an oppressed person, or as a Muslima and an oppressed person, or as a trans, non-binary, endo-queer and oppressed person, victimhood is a cash cow on the identity market these days. How are people who have the ear of CNN, the New York Times, MSNBC, any of the online media, these people have have the ear of all of these media, because the minute they claim that somebody looked at them cross-eyed or didn't look at them or microaggressed and they have one of the special queer woman race identities, they're all oppressed. They can get on the news basically for having a tantrum. Oppressed people are not on the cover of Time magazine over and over again. They are not on CNN every single day. Their stories and their tears and their struggles are not narrated every bloody day in the New York Times, but these people are talked about every single day on these media. I mean, it's just astonishing. As a gay guy, for example, when I started going to gay pride events as a teenager, I was young and I couldn't see a lot of what was already starting to happen then. But at least in that era, I mean, what are we talking about? About 30 years ago. We still did have legal battles to fight. We still did have to win the right to marriage and several other things. You know, I've lived in a cosmopolitan place for most of my life since then. So, you know, I'm not living, you know, in places where there's a lot of homophobia. But it really has been about 25 years since I have personally experienced anything that I would call that I would say rises to the level of labeling it homophobia, where I felt like I was either in imminent physical danger or that I was in danger of something like losing my job or the lease on my apartment. I mean, things have gotten so much better, so very much better. I don't see the oppression. And I'm not sure why so many other people are convinced about that. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about the latest purge at the New York Times. So stay with us. Let's talk about Stockholm Syndrome at the New York Times. It's really astonishing how quickly the new left cultural revolution is picking up pace. Donald Trump's absence has done absolutely nothing to calm down the excesses of the social justice left and seems to have been an indication to people that they have even greater free reign. Folks, obviously, most of you watching or listening to this don't know me and haven't known me. I don't know you. But if you had known me, if we did know each other, if you had told me even 4 or 5 years ago that I would be sitting here and talking about how frightening I find the New York Times or National Public Radio. I never would have believed you, because I've spent most of my life as a left-leaning person, a very partisan Democrat. I treated the New York Times as it wanted to be seen, you know, its identity as the paper of record. Or the old gray lady whose slip is really in tatters now. And so I'm sure that I didn't see some of these things that other people were able to see more clearly, who didn't have the partisan emotional allegiance that I had. But it's gotten so much worse. This week, the New York Times let go of two longtime writers for what appear to me to be very questionable reasons. And one of them was longtime science writer Don McNeil. And apparently the genesis for McNeil's firing was a complaint letter signed by 150 New York Times staffers that he had used what they call the N-word and should be sacked for it. And just as an aside, I resent the fact that I just said the N-word, and I resent the fact that even though I want to, I can't actually say what the N-word is, because, and this is why this story is important, because we've lost the use and endorsement distinction, right? We are now, you remember that story? I don't remember how many years ago, God, it could be 10, 15, could be even 20 years ago, when there was a hue and cry in at least one American school district over Mark Sawyer, Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, for using the N-word in a novel that was clearly written as not sympathetic to racists. This is still going on. So apparently, from what I can gather, Don McNeil went on a trip overseas with some students at some kind of junket that the New York Times was promoting, you know, learned with a reporter. I'm not quite sure what it was. And there was some discussion on that trip about somebody who had said the N-word. And apparently Don McNeil had some questions about that. How was it used? Was it being mentioned? You know, this, that, or the other thing. And apparently the very fact that he uttered the word itself, however many years ago this was, needed to be brought up, and he needed to be put on trial. So the New York Times let him go. And a lot of people, I think, are rightly upset and disturbed at the fact that, I mean, we've seen this other times, right, where a whole cabal of people at a company will get angry at someone else who works at their company and go on a campaign to defame their character. We've seen it happen to the British writer Suzanne Moore, who was hounded out of The Guardian for, again, defending women's rights and saying trans rights can't actually impede women's rights or we have a problem here. We have this situation where these apparently vaunted longstanding institutions are willingly placing themselves in a hostage situation with their woke staff. I've never seen anything like it in my life. What power do these disgruntled and vindictive people have over the top editors at these places that they're just jumping to their tune? So, yes, this is a problem. But what really got me was not the behavior of these nasty colleagues at the New York Times and the cowardly and morally repugnant capitulation of the Times management and editorial staff to their demands, but the way that Don McNeil himself gleefully participated in his own humiliation. After he was fired, this is the letter he wrote. And I'm sorry if this looks a little awkward. I left my reading glasses at home, and I'm going to try to read this. So, again, this is important. This happened after Don McNeil was fired. That's when he wrote this. To the staff of the Times, on a 2019 New York Times trip to Peru for high school students, I was asked at dinner by a student whether I thought a classmate of hers should have been suspended for a video she had made as a 12-year-old in which she made a racial slur. To understand what was in the video, I asked if she had called someone else the slur or whether she was rapping or quoting a book title. In asking the question, I used the slur itself. I should not have done that. Originally, I thought the context in which I used this ugly word could be defended. I now realize that it cannot. It is deeply offensive and hurtful. The fact that I even thought I could defend it showed extraordinarily bad judgment. For that, I apologize. To the students on the trip, I also extend my sincerest apology. But my apology needs to be broader than that. My lapse of judgment has hurt my colleagues in science, the hundreds of people who trusted me to work with them closely during this pandemic, the team at The Daily that turned to me during this frightening year, and the whole institution which put its confidence in me and expected better. So for offending my colleagues and for anything I've done to hurt the Times, which is an institution I love and whose mission I believe in and try to serve, I am sorry. I let you all down. Donald G. McNeil, Jr. God, that's painful. That's it's pathetic. I have such mixed emotions about this. At once, I am sympathetic to the terror that must be going on in this man's mind to make him mortify himself the way he's doing. But on the other hand, there isn't a way on God's green earth you could ever get me to make a statement like that. I would sooner die than cooperate in my own ritual abasement. This is the only thing that's missing from this is the sexual element, because it's sadomasochistic passion play. It's disgusting. There was a time. This is a hostage letter, okay? This is a hostage letter. You can imagine somebody just off camera with a gun pointing at Don McNeil's head. I had to write hostage letters when I was a teenage boy being interrogated by the staff of the institution that I had been placed in when family court took me out of my home. So, between the time I was 12 and 13, things had gotten out of control at home. I'd tried to kill myself twice. I had become extraordinarily depressed. My mother's insanity, as well as the approach of adolescence and the fact that I was trying to integrate the fact that I was gay and I couldn't hide it anymore. All of these pressures were really driving me crazy. And we lived in a crazy household, right? Like people find this amusing, and I'm glad. If you actually get a kick out of this, that's fine. You're allowed to laugh. It's funny, but it's also deadly serious. The best way to describe my mother and the way she raised us, she was a cross between Joan Crawford in A Trailer Park and Margaret White, Carrie White's mother in the movie Carrie, the religious fanatic. My mother was not a religious fanatic, but she was and is a narcissist and a borderline and sometimes delusional in her disconnection from reality and in her frantic efforts to command her children to perform the emotions and the fealty and the obedience that she thought was her due. So the proximate event that got me kicked out of my house was the final fight that I had with my mother, again, sometime between 12 and 13. I don't remember what the fight was about. What I do remember is that it was one of those situations where my mother has a sadistic streak, and she liked to watch her kids squirm. And when they squirmed and when they got angry and they wanted to rage, she would do sadistic things like say, "Smile. I don't want to see that look on your face. Smile and say yes, ma'am." It's really, really kooky and deranged. We were having one of these fights, and she said something. She was enjoying watching me get worked up. And she started to smirk. The angrier I got and the more I told her to leave me alone, stop yelling at me, stop telling me what to do, the more delighted she got. And I, again, I don't remember what it was, but I do remember she said something that was so humiliating to me in my heightened emotional state that for a minute I saw her really clearly. Her mask came right off. She was getting off on it. She liked it. She liked seeing me tremble and try to stop myself from raging at her. And I lost it. I lost control and I hauled off and I hit her as hard as I could across the face. And I said something I'm not going to repeat here, but it was accurate. That was the proximate event that got me kicked out of the home. And as difficult as it was being put into an institution and a group home, it might actually have saved my life and my mother's. Things were bad enough that they could have gone a lot worse and very quickly. I don't know what the staff at this institution knew about my mother. I don't know if any of them saw through her facade. It didn't feel like that to me at the time. I'm betting there probably were some, but not Mr. H. Mr. H, I don't know what you call him. I guess they called them counselors. They were... at this point, I was living in a house with 12 or 15 other boys. It was a really big house on this institution's campus. And it was the emergency placement house. So it's where incorrigible boys got put for a 30 or 60 day evaluation period before family court decided whether they should be sent back home or placed into a long term group care facility. But they would have the parents come up on the weekends and do counseling and therapy sessions with their kids. So Mr. H was one of the staff members, and he used to do these counseling coaching sessions that my mother would come up for on the weekends. And they were basically a recitation of everything that was wrong with me and my disobedience. And I remember one day, it's hard to describe this. I'd be sitting there, and he'd be sitting there, and my mother would be sitting over here. So it was like the two of them against me. And again, folks, I'm not claiming that I was a perfect kid, and I'm not even claiming that at that time I was a good kid. I was out of control, for sure. There were reasons for it, and most of those reasons were my mother. But yes, I had severe behavioral problems. I did need help. But I needed help. I didn't need what I got. And what I got was Mr. H would go off and use these long-winded analogies, and he would ask me, why are you doing this? Why don't you listen to your mother? Why don't you do this or that? What is it that you're really trying to do, Josh? And what I was really trying to do was to get this woman to stop abusing me, stop screaming at me, stop dragging me out of my bed at midnight and hauling me down the stairs by the collar at the back of my neck, and then picking the dishes out of the dish strainer and saying, does this look clean to you? Does this fucking look clean to you? Sorry, but that's not an exaggeration. That's what home was like. How could other people ask me what I was trying to do? I was trying to get her to stop. But Mr. H said, you know, Josh, you're saying all the right things, but I don't think you're really being honest with us. And, you know, let me tell you a story about when I was in the Vietnam War and do. And that's what you're doing, Josh. You're leading us down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And do. I have no idea. I know what the Ho Chi Minh Trail is. I didn't know that I was on it. And I'm not sure how it fit together. But I had to respond as a hostage in this situation. The only way to make this stop, the only way to get privileges, you know, not to have to go to bed at a certain time or to be allowed to have, you know, an extra 20 minutes at the foosball table, I had to say yes, sir, no, sir. And I had to admit to all of my faults, and I had to admit that I was disrespectful to my mother, and I had to say that I knew she didn't deserve it. And I had to write letters out about, you know, what a misguided and bad boy I was, and how I was going to do better, And here are all the things I've learned about why I'm deceptive and what I'm going to do to address that and make sure that I'm a better person in the future. It's bad enough to put a kid through that when the real problem is a deranged and disordered parent. But I have a much harder time understanding a grown adult like Don McNeil, an accomplished science reporter who I think he'd been with the Times for more than 40 years, after he got fired, writing this kind of hostage letter. And some people have said, maybe he had to do that as part of his severance package, and maybe he did. I don't know Don's situation. I don't know how he's fixed financially. I don't know what his being let go from the Times really means for him economically and socially, or for his job prospects in the future. I'm very sorry he was in this situation. I'm sure he's terrified, but honestly, it's pitiful. And these people will grind you down until there's nothing left of you. Don't cooperate with them. Don't write hostage letters. Don't apologize. Stop saying you're sorry. If you have done something wrong, legitimately wrong, yes, you need to apologize. You need to do it publicly and in front of the people that you did something wrong for. But do you need to apologize? This happens to a lot of us. We're in a tense situation, and we think that there's a mob that's going to come after us. We're trying to think defensively, and so I'm really sorry if I did it. That's a mistake. Please tamp that reflex down, because this is just showing the chink in your armor. It's pulling your belly up and saying, you know, it's like being Smaug in the Hobbit. You know, hey, this is the chink in my armor. This is the place where I don't have a scale. This is where an arrow will work. So shoot here. That's what you're doing. We're going to take another break and come right back. So I want to end this week with another little tableau from Facebook, because, as I've said before, they are so instructive. I'm going to put a picture up here because you need to see what I'm seeing. So this is a screenshot from an article in the UK's newspaper, The Independent, of a trans woman becoming herself. Look at this picture. This is the dude, and this is the dude after transing. Okay, take a look at it. Take it in. This is another form of being a hostage, and frankly, being in a tent revival as well, and a form of Tinkerbell ontology. The way people react to this. First of all, what woman would get a feature story in a magazine or a newspaper for being her authentic self with brand new fake tits, brand new fake wig, and Disney villainess drag queen makeup? Would any woman be applauded this way? Obviously not. Why are we doing it with men like this? What are we engaged in? What are people trying to sell us? I expect this kind of thing from narcissists. I expect people like this, who I believe show every sign of a severe and probably unstable personality disorder. I expect them to act this way. Remember how I talked about one of the key features of borderline personality disorder being an unstable and ever-changing sense of self-image and identity? Is not transing the most crystal clear example of this that you could think of? It's incredible to me. 20 years ago, when the big scourge affecting teen girls was anorexia and bulimia, therapists could see immediately that many of these girls were suffering from trauma, and particularly at least incipient borderline personality disorder. the unstable sense of self, the feelings of worthlessness that lead to impulsive behavior like cutting, starving yourself, substance abuse, these sorts of things. This is classic. I mean, it's not necessarily the case that everybody who does this has BPD, but it's a huge correlation. And now all of a sudden, you see this same extreme behavior in young women who are getting mastectomies and saying, I'm a boy or I'm a gay man, or older men like this. Look at this guy. He's a big bodybuilder. You know, he's very concerned about, you know, being muscular. And by the way, there's work and studies out there that say, hey, you know, sometimes men are underdiagnosed with borderline personality disorder because we associate it with things we think are feminine. But, you know, take a look at these extreme bodybuilders and tell me that this is not a male typical expression of borderline personality disorder, right? I think there's something to that. So then this guy comes along and claims he's a woman. He puts on a wig. He wears, frankly, he wears a costume that suggests prostitution, as so many of them do who end up being featured in magazines and newspapers. He's got himself some ginormous fake tits bolted to the front of him, and he's wearing drag queen makeup. This looks like an unstable identity to me, but what does it look like to people on Facebook? Here's a sample. You can hardly tell it's the same person. She's beautiful. Congratulations for becoming yourself, Miss Tuft. I'm hoping to become my true self, too. Awesome. Good for her. Never too late to live your authentic life. Why would anyone laugh at this? A fellow human is happily living their authenticity with no threat to another. Be happy for them. Which part of this is the authenticity part? Is it the tank top? Is it the makeup? Is it the silicone tits? Is it the affected, contorted body language so that he appears to have a female hourglass figure? Which part's authentic and which part's not? And why are people saying this? Why are they acting like they are hostages? And this thread has a mix of men and women in it, but I got to tell you folks, and any of you who've watched these threads happen before, you know that I'm right about this. At least 80% of the clapping, tearful, joyful affirmation comes from women. There's something about trans that this is a women's religious cult. They seem to be trying to outdo each other in sainthood. And it's really grotesque because the men that they're putting their clapping and their affirmation behind are the kind of men who are, you cannot be blamed for thinking they might be a little bit dangerous to women. They might be a little bit unstable. So, as I sometimes do, I seeded the pot to see how people would react. And I wrote, I was a little bit more certain than I should have been. So just here, I believe or I suspect. This is a dangerous and unstable cluster B personality disorder case. But really, do go on pretending that this dude is a sweet lady and you all can see it. Oh, about 24 responses after that, an absolute high dudgeon. How could I? This, that, and the other thing. Why was I so hateful? Oh, this one. Josh, you're a deplorable human. Small-minded pricks like you will likely die alone. Another one from a dude. Josh, go run your mouth like that to her face. Bet you wouldn't dare. That's it right there. These people don't believe anything they're saying. That guy said that because he knows that's a dude who could beat the shit out of me and probably would if I were standing in front of him. He wouldn't have said that if he really thought this was a woman. Okay? And again, I don't care what Ms. Tuft does. It does not pick my pocket or break my leg for him to wear women's clothes, call himself by a female name. Any of this is absolutely fine. I can't believe that I'm having to say that this is okay with me since I'm a person who spent my entire life around people who broke gender stereotypes and I used to be a drag queen part-time for comedy fun myself. And yes, I am making an equivalence. This is drag. He's wearing drag. He's not a woman. He's wearing drag. But this is all of a piece, folks. The religious revival the tent revival going on at the Capitol where everybody claims to be traumatized and everyone claims that, you know, they're so grateful to be bathed in the tears of affirmation. It's of a piece with Don McNeil being fired from the New York Times and then committing social Harry Caray on himself by writing that pathetic and frankly contemptible letter, mortifying himself. I mean, it's like a medieval passion play where the monks go down the center of the street and flay themselves with whips on the back. And it's we're all acting like hostages. We're all acting like hostages to these people. And some of us seem to be really enjoying it. There'll be more next week. Thanks for joining me for Disaffected, folks. Take care. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to Disaffected. You can get us on Apple's iTunes, Spotify, Rumble, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's a really good time to subscribe because everybody who's subscribed is going to get a special feature. We have an hour-long audio-only interview with my friend, the artist Nina Paley, best known for her feature films, her animated feature films, Sita Sings the Blues and Seder Masochism. So if you haven't subscribed yet, please do so. And tell a friend, you're not going to find content like this on any other podcast right now. And it does take some courage for people to speak out about this stuff. All I'm asking you to do is hit the subscribe button and tell somebody else. Thank you.